You have a big antenna farm out in the desert somewhere, a couple miles in diameter, and you simply collect the microwaves and turn them into electrical energy in exactly the same way as a radio antenna does.
Radio, you convert
it by
applying power.
Well, yes. In radio, the energy density is in a normal radio, the energy density is very tiny because you're not dealing with such very large amounts of energy as we're talking about here. The energy density of sunlight doesn't sound like much until you figure out how much of it there is in several square miles. And you say, well, why don't you just cut out the sunlight over several square miles? Because that isn't a constant source. You can have it at night. It's the energy density of a high moon somewhere, let's put it that way. And it's that way all the time for energy to see both things either. So you went down a couple of miles across. That's a lot of energy. And yeah, there's hundreds of these power satellites up there too, not just one. Something that I don't know is whether each one requires its own antenna. I think that's true. But I don't see any reason why you couldn't have one antenna collecting more than one beam.
It's actually electrical energy,
not even. It is electrical energy, well, it's electromagnetic waves in the form that it's sent back, but any form of energy is likely to get converted into heat. You know, heat is the ultimate sink for energy in general, and so if you have a microwave oven, it's microwaves that are being produced inside the oven. However, when they hit the meat absorbs them and they get turned into heat as a result of that absorption. And if you're silly enough to stick your hand in there, then what happened to your hand? That's kind of what we're talking about. Okay, well, people are still coming in, but we've got to get started at some point. Because this is going to be a rather long and difficult lecture. It'll be in two parts. This one is the first half, really, of a lecture, and there is no reasonable way to cut it in half. So I simply have to stop talking and ask you to pick up the threads again next week. The lecture is about Viking biology, and the reason that it is long and difficult and there's no way to make it shorter, there's no way to cut it in half, is very simply that we don't know the answer yet. We do not yet know whether there is life on Mars. This is something which seems to be intolerable to 99% of the news reporters. They insist on the answer, and there isn't a the answer yet. And so what they typically do is badger the poor scientists into expressing some sort of opinion or probability, no matter how tenuous. And the scientists try hard to avoid doing that entirely because they simply do not know. But, you know, finally you can narrow the guy down and say, well, my intuitive feeling for what it's worth, which is very little, is that there's a slightly greater probability, you know, of one than the other, and then that's what the headline says is the answer. And so this is the reason that you've seen this series of mutually contradictory news reports about, yes, there's probably life on Mars, and no, there's probably not life on Mars, and so forth. The fact is, we simply do not know. And the reason we do not know is that the results are very interesting. And that is a point which I would like to make clear to you at the very beginning. If the results were uninteresting, we could probably give you an answer by this time. Because the uninteresting results would be if all the instruments had simply gotten a flat zero reading, then we could tell you definitely no. Not know there is life on Mars, the thing that the Vikings cannot possibly prove, but know there is no life at the places we landed, at the times we landed, which responded to the test which in our ignorance we thought were universal and would detect life anyway. That's a very different statement from there is no life on Mars, and it's an even more different statement from there never has been any life on Mars, which is a thing that would probably take centuries to prove. However, that is not what's happened. The instruments have not gotten flat zero readings, they have gotten readings which have become progressively more unbelievable and more bizarre and more unlike what anybody expected, whether they thought there was life on Mars or not. And so at this stage, all I can tell you is we have stumbled on something of major importance, of a sort, something or other, of a sort which simply does not exist on the Earth, and that all of our experience in both biology and in non-living chemistry had never given us any hint that was out there and that we should look for. And so it is a major discovery of some sort, but since it is so unexpected, it is way too early to be able to tell you what it is that we found. And so what I'm going to do in these lectures is something in the nature of a progress report. That is, I'm going to throw all the data at you in their raw, undigested form, and then leave you in the same state of confusion and ignorance as is enjoyed by the professionals in the field, because that's all that I can do at this point. You say, well, wait a minute, isn't that a kind of silly thing to do? Why don't you wait until we've got the answer and then give this lecture? Well, there are several reasons that I didn't do that, the first being that I knew I would get lynched if I gave a lecture series on Viking and didn't mention biology. But because most people think that that's all there is to Viking, and of course one of the reasons that I gave you the other three first is so that you would realize how very, very much more in fact there is. And also so that you would realize that there is a great deal from Viking which is quite definite, which we've discovered, and which we know what it is, you know, there are a lot of cases where the answer is in fact no. More things coming in all the time. For example, there are two different kinds of giant volcanoes on Mars. There are the large shield volcanoes of the sort that I was showing you on the first day, and then there is a separate class of objects which, when they were discovered by Mariner 9, a lot of geologists thought were just older versions of the shield volcanoes, now eroded into almost invisibility. They are not. They are a fundamentally different kind of object, and they've always been about the way they look now, which is, in some cases, even wider than Olympus Mons. Alba Patera, which is the biggest of these things, is three times the diameter of Olympus Mons. This is a mountain almost 1,000 miles across, but it is only 2 miles high. And so when I use the word mountain, I'm speaking rather loosely. You could be walking along in the thing for dozens of miles and not have any sense that you were climbing a mountain at all. Very recently, just last week in fact, it was announced that several of these Patera-type mountains have been photographed by Viking orders 1 and 2, both, and they are covered with all sorts of things, delicate features like lava flow edges and lava flow channels and so on, which would certainly not have survived the miles of erosion necessary to lower something the height of Olympus Mons, 15 miles high, down to something as low as Alba Patera. So in fact, Alba Patera has always been about the way it is now. And so now we've got to find out why there are two kinds of volcanoes and so forth. That's just one example, which I throw out because it's a new one and I hadn't mentioned it. And here is an example of something which is so new that I gave a lecture on it only 4 weeks ago, which is already out of date in this one respect. You know, and lots more things coming in. Well, the same thing is true of biology. If I gave you a lecture anytime, short of several years after the first landing on biology, I'm sure it would be out of date. Because the biological investigation is, after all, the most complex unmanned space investigation that has ever been undertaken by anybody, simply because light is a more complex phenomenon than any of the other things that you look at. A living thing is very, very much more complicated than a mountain. So it's a lot harder to understand, it's a lot harder even to detect. But there's another consideration too, and that is that not to talk about it until the answer is known, which is what the news reporters, of course, are trying to do, if they only realize would really be cheating you of an absolutely unparalleled, literally once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the great majority of you. Some of you may be scientists or may be working in science or may have worked in scientific laboratories, and in that case, you're not the ones that I'm talking to in this particular respect. But most of you are not. You know, you're looking at it from the outside, you're interested in science, but you're not involved in it personally. And what happens generally in a scientific investigation is that there's always an initial stage where the data are still coming in and you don't know what they mean, especially if it's true when it's something, when you've discovered something that you weren't expecting. And so you're still trying to figure out what's happening and you are dreaming up possible explanations and testing them and discarding them at the rate of 6 a day and dreaming up still more explanations. And then finally you get one that looks as though it's holding up and it seems to explain all the data you got up to that point, and you're just about happy with it, and all of a sudden here comes a fresh bunch of data which throw you back to square one. You've got to throw out the entire idea and start over, And after you're happy with it, then you try to convince your colleagues and see if some of them are happy with it, so on and so forth. And then just as soon as you think you finally got the answer, some turkey comes along with one little subtle chink in your whole picture, and again you're back to square one and so forth. And then finally, after the end of a long series of this kind of process, finally you get to the point where all the data are in and you have got an explanation that does hold up, at least this is, you know, ideally what happens, and finally at that stage you publish it. And it is usually only then that the outside world finds out for the first time that the experiment was even in progress. You know, it's generally the very first they've ever heard about it, let alone that you had any doubts or uncertainties in your mind before that. Well, all right, fine. What we've got here in Viking is a very different sort of thing. It is literally science in a fishbowl. What we've got in Viking as the result of what I consider an extremely courageous and praiseworthy decision on the part of the Viking people, is the Viking Project people, is an opportunity for the public to see the entire process of scientific research in action. Everything has been thrown open and nothing is being hidden, and all the data are being released to the public just as soon as they come in, before anybody understands them, and you can play with them just as much as a scientist can, and also all the preliminary stages and the tentative hypotheses and so forth are also being thrown open to the public. And not only is this happening, it's happening with obviously one of the most important scientific investigations in your lifetime, and it is literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you to see science in action. So what I'm going to do is give you a progress report, and furthermore, I'm going to give you a somewhat historical progress report, and I'm going to go through the whole series of data as they came in and build up some hypotheses for you and then tear them down, the things that have already happened. This would be the sort of thing that you would know if you've been watching every last minute of it as it went along, as I have, of course, for the last few months. I'll have to give it to you all in a couple of nights, and that will destroy the historical progression aspect of it a little bit, but I'll try to preserve that as much as I can. But, I repeat, if you are the kind of person who doesn't care about any of the details, and you want to know an answer, and that's all you're interested in, you are not going to get it, either from me or from anybody else. And if there is somebody who claims he's got an answer at this stage, he's simply fooling you. And that goes for 99% of the news reporters that supposedly tell you what is going on with this thing. So, the best answer at this point to the question, is there life on Mars, is still the classic one. Well, there's a little on Saturday night, but it's awfully dead the rest of the week. It's interesting that the first two news conferences at which data were announced, which made it look as though there might have been life on Mars, were in fact on two successive Saturday nights, and it was during the following week that each one of them was, let's say, didn't look quite as good as it had on Saturday night. And so it makes you look as it makes you wonder as though the whole thing isn't really true. I'm also amused by one aspect of the news reporting, and that is the exasperation that many of the reporters showed out there at Jet Propulsion Laboratory when the biologists were trying to give press conferences in which they announced the latest bit of information. The exasperation of the reporters was the scientists' refusal to give an answer, or to give even a tentative answer when in fact they didn't know. It has become fashionable in recent years to sneer at the pretensions of science, of scientists, to objectivity and to not being prejudiced and to operating only in terms of the cold facts and rationally and unemotionally and so forth and so on, because you can find here and there in the history of science cases where scientists have acted like the human beings that they are and been irrational and acted blindly and acted emotionally. And, you know, it's since we have so much anti-scientism popular now, it is popular to separate those out and act as though they were the norm. Well, here you have a beautiful example of scientists behaving exactly the way they're supposed to and refusing to go beyond the data, even when the reporters beg them to, and insisting on admitting they don't know the answer when they don't know the answer, and it just drives the reporters crazy. And it's just really amusing, you know, to sit back and watch this process in action. Well, before I get into the data, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking general philosophy,
and that is to ask you the question, why is it important to look for life on Mars? Now, that is one that is so basic that, you know, maybe you haven't thought to ask yourself that even if you've had your doubts about some other space investigations, there's a big difference between is it important to study Martian volcanoes and is it important to look for life on Mars in the emotions of the average person. And I think that your intuitive answer that it's important because one of the big philosophic questions that have haunted us for thousands of years is the nature of life and the nature of what we are, and surely one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, which will be the answer to that kind of question, is the question of how common life is through the universe. Is it a rare accidental phenomenon that has happened only on this Earth for reasons that are very unusual, or is it in fact something that is widespread throughout the universe and really a major part of nature? And I have no quarrel with that. Man does not live by bread alone, and so forth. But there are a few non-obvious, or let's say less obvious, reasons for looking at life on Mars that I'd like to point out to you. And one of them is the same sort of thing that I've talked about before in other contexts, geological and meteorological, and that is that one of the big reasons for studying other planets and phenomena on them at this particular stage in the history of the human race, when we are still all confined to a single planet, and when they aren't ours yet, one of the reasons is to understand better the planet that we live on. And so you go and you study other planets' meteorologies and you learn things that you can use to better predict weather on the Earth. Because we only have one meteorology on Earth to study, and therefore we don't know which of its characteristics are fundamental and which are accidental. Well, the same thing is true, whether you're aware of it or not, of life. There is really only one life form on Earth. That is a very startling sounding statement unless you have been following the trend of biology for about the last 15 years. Because before that time, biologists were always more impressed with the differences between different kinds of living organisms than the similarities. And certainly the differences superficially appear more important. The difference between you and a whale and a sequoia and a cockroach and an amoeba appears very much larger than the similarities. But we have found in the last 15 years that in fact, where the action really is in biology is on the molecular level. It is down at the chemical level inside the cells that all of the things that operate, all the phenomena that operate living things, including those that make them different from other living things, operate. And all of those are just the same. All biochemistry on Earth is identical, with very, very tiny and minor exceptions. We all have the same genetic code, we are all made of the same proteins, composed of the same amino acids, doing the same things in the same ways, and even quite minor details, for example, the punctuation in the genetic code, are identical throughout the animal and plant kingdoms, and whatever other kingdoms the biologists are dreaming up these days. I think there are up to 5 of them by now. They're all identical. And there is a very simple, straightforward reason for that, which is obvious after you've thought of it. And that is, we have all got to be made of the same substances, or we will not be able to eat each other. And it is very important that we be able to eat each other. If you are going to have life on a planet, that life has got to be in ecological balance. You have got to have a situation where, for every organism, A, that is trying to live and breed and multiply and take over the Earth in one glorious population explosion, there is another organism, B, which prevents it from doing that by preying upon it. And of course, usually it's not just A and B, you know, it's much more complicated than that, but you see what I'm getting at. There has got to be a situation where the organisms are keeping one another, and the different kinds of organisms are keeping one another in control, and there is no way that you're going to be able to do that if they are made of fundamentally different substances. All that will happen then, if they try to eat each other, is they will get very bad stomach aches. And they won't be able to get any sort of nourishment from one another, which of course is the reward that nature has built in to ensure this process is going to occur. Well, okay, so what that means is that we have learned a great deal about our biochemistry in the last 15 years, and we are beginning to get to the point where we can really do big things with it. The science of molecular biochemistry is really taking off. And we are reaching the point where we are stymied by that same old thing all over again, that we've only got one biochemistry to study, and therefore we don't know which of its features are truly significant and which are accidental. And that is something that you have got to know if you are going to understand what your own biochemistry is about, and if you are going to understand, for example, disorders of that biochemistry, such as cancer. The only way we are going to understand our own biochemistry is to go somewhere else in the universe where there is another closed system, all of whose members can eat each other, but isn't related to ours, and study the differences and the similarities and see how they go together. We do not know at this point the extent to which the kind of life that exists on the Earth, no singular kind of life that exists on Earth, is the only kind of life that can exist throughout the universe, versus the extent to which you can have all kinds of possibilities, of which the one we happen to have is just the way it happens to have come out on our particular planet, and it could have been very different. And the only way we're going to find out is by going to Mars. So you will notice that the interest in studying Martian life, if it in fact it exists, even at this early stage where you're interested in bare detection, is not particularly in what it looks like. There are no microscopes on the Viking landers. But rather, even at this early stage, what we're trying to find out about it already is its chemistry. We are doing very simple chemical investigations at this stage because biochemistry is so horrendously complex. But if you start asking really profound questions, well, if it isn't exactly like the kind you already know, then you know, you're simply not going to get any answers because the differences will put it outside the range of your instruments. But nevertheless, it's chemistry that we are really after and that we're really interested in studying here. Now, there's another consideration, too. Probably, for reasons that I'll show you a little bit later on, life on Mars, if it exists at all, is restricted to microbes. That is, to single-celled animals, plants, or whatever might happen to exist on Mars, equivalents of the bacteria and algae and other simple organisms on Earth. And that will undoubtedly come as a disappointment to many people, because, after all, they've been programmed for a long time to believe that the only things that are really interesting are huge green hairy monsters with 15 tentacles that are going to steal the beautiful girl in the science fiction story unless something drastic is done about it. We're not going to get huge hairy monsters with 15 tentacles on Mars, almost certainly, and it is probably significant that nothing obviously alive, big enough to show up in the Viking lander pictures, has in fact shown up in them. Now, that's a little bit hasty a statement, because we've only seen 1/2 millionth of the surface of Mars in those pictures, but nevertheless, to the extent that it's typical, certainly there is nothing at all obviously alive in them. So, I'm sure that if life is discovered on Mars, there will be a period of intense public euphoria for about a week, at the end of which some senator or congressman will make a statement which will be widely reported in the press, something of the effect of, you mean to tell me we spent $1 billion to go to Mars and find germs? But you see, it's enormous. In the first place, we didn't. There's much more to Viking, but he'll ignore that. In the second place, it's already paid for itself, but he'll ignore that. And in the third place, finding germs on Mars would be enormously important, even with respect to the question that most people are really, most non-scientists, the general public, are really interested in, that is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? And we've long since given up any real hope of finding intelligent life, not only on Mars, but anywhere in our own solar system. But the question of intelligent life in the universe is certainly one that is open. And we do not know the answer to it. And the reason we don't know the answer to it is that we are far too ignorant at this stage. There are way too many things that we've got to know the answers to before we can put even a probability on it. How common are planets, assuming that life requires planets, that are capable of supporting life? We don't know the answer to that. We don't even know how common planets are, for that matter, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Given planets which are capable of supporting life, how easy or difficult is it for nature to bring life into being on those planets? At the moment, the thinking is it's very easy. It's a more or less natural sort of thing. It happened inevitably in the early history of the Earth. It would happen inevitably in the early history of any planet more or less like the Earth. I claim we are far too ignorant to be able to make a statement like that, and we're going to be right up to the point where, if it's so darn easy, we are able to do it in the laboratory, which you notice we can't do yet. We cannot create life in the laboratory. So we don't know how easy or difficult it is. It would not surprise me in the least if it turned out that the origin of life required a series of happenings that were so unlikely and so improbable, and they all had to go so exactly right, that it only happened on one planet in the entire universe, which of course by definition is the one that we are on. So the mere fact that we are here is not any kind of proof or even probability indication that they are there. But suppose you go out someplace else in the universe, never mind where, and find any other form of life, never mind what kind. Right away you know the answer. Right away you know the origin of life must be very common. Because it's simply stretching probabilities to ridiculous extent to suggest that there are only two places in the whole universe where there's life, and there are two neighboring planets in the very same solar system. If there's any kind of life on Mars, even bacteria, it enormously increases the probability that life of some sort has come into existence elsewhere. That still doesn't prove there's intelligent life. There's still a whole string of questions beyond that that we don't know the answers to. For example, given a planet where life has come into existence, how likely is that life to continue in existence on the planet? Given a planet where all that has happened, how likely is that life to develop intelligence? And so forth and so on. But at least it would be one more important piece in the jigsaw puzzle. And it would increase the probability of intelligent life elsewhere, although it certainly would not prove it. Okay, there's another consideration. Suppose that there is no life on Mars, which, I repeat, the Vikings cannot prove, but suppose there isn't. That itself would be almost as important a finding and teaches almost as much about the origin of life as if there is life there. Because we have shown, the Vikings have shown, that Mars is a suitable environment for life of the sort that exists on the Earth. And I've already mentioned examples of that. For example, last week I mentioned the discovery of nitrogen in the Martian atmosphere, which was the last in the list of substances known to be necessary for all life on the Earth. And I mentioned in an earlier lecture about the Montmorillonite clay. So, no one can weasel out of a finding that there's no life on Mars by saying, oh, well, you wouldn't have expected it there because the environment isn't suitable, and so that doesn't prove anything. The environment is suitable, and so in finding out why our planet, just knowing, just having one hint that our planet has produced life and that planet where it ought to be suitable hasn't produced life, we get a powerful hint as to what conditions are necessary for the origin of life on a planet and how likely or unlikely it is. So, as so often happens in basic research, you can't lose. A no answer, although it may be disappointing, teaches you just about as much as a yes answer. At the moment, we have neither. But either way it comes out, if it turns out there is no life on Mars, or even if it turns out the Vikings haven't found any, I hope that none of you will make the terrible mistake, which I'm sure many, many millions of people will, of concluding the entire Viking program was a failure and was a waste of money and so forth and so on. It'll be a very important success. There's no way you can avoid being it at this stage. The only way I can think of it would have been a failure would have been if all four spacecraft had crashed. And that hasn't happened. Even that would have paid for itself. Viking does not literally look for life. There is no microscope on the spacecraft. The idea is not to comb through the microbes and hope to comb through the soil grain and hope to find some little paramecium swimming out of you behind the, one of them and get a good picture of it before he does so. That approach was, of course, looked at, and very, very quickly it was realized that it is simply an impractical approach. For one thing, as I mentioned the first week, it's impossible to build a television camera that would survive the sterilization that was necessary on the Viking landers if they were going to look for life in the first place. And it seems a little bit hard to imagine how that facsimile camera could have been adapted to operating through a microscope. But there's another consideration, too. You have no idea what Martian life looks like. You have no idea how common or rare it is in your soil sample. You might not recognize it when you found it. No way. The way you look for life on Mars, quote unquote, is to look for chemical changes that living things produce in the environment. And that is a characteristic of life. We all pollute. We like to think that we do so in a way that is not permanently damaging, and if you have an ecological balance on the planet, by definition, you do not. But every living thing changes its environment chemically. And I'll give you a simple example of how that operates. Suppose that some creatures from outer space were trying to prove whether there was life in this room, and they don't know anything about us, and they don't know anything about what we look like, and so forth. One way they could do it would be to seal off the room and then measure the composition of the atmosphere in the room every 10 minutes or so. And as they did so, they would find that slowly, over the course of time, the amount of oxygen in the air was steadily going down, and the amount of carbon dioxide was steadily going up. All right? That's your first step. See what chemical changes, if any, do in fact occur. But you haven't proved yet that there's life in this room. Suppose there was a fire in the room instead, and no oxygen. That could produce exactly the same sort of thing, depending on what was burning. There are a wide variety of things that could possibly burn, and in doing so, reduce the amount of oxygen and increase the amount of carbon dioxide. So after you have found out what chemical changes occur, then you've got to ask yourself, all right, if it's life, how would things be different from if it isn't life? You've got to design further experiments to check your initial hypothesis, this thing is caused by life. Well, if there was a fire in here, it would probably be a good deal higher temperature than if there were a living thing. And so you measure the temperature and you find, gee, there doesn't really seem to be enough energy being released. It isn't being released at a fast enough rate to suggest that it's combustion, which is producing the observed rate of changes. However, suppose instead somebody's got a bunch of Coleman heaters in the room. I'm using Coleman heaters as an example of catalysis, an example that you may happen to have heard of. Coleman heaters, of course, are artificially built, so I'm not suggesting anybody was serious to come up with that particular thing. But a catalyst is a substance which is capable of allowing a chemical reaction to occur much more easily than it would otherwise, and therefore can allow it to occur at a very, very much more slow, controlled rate than it would otherwise. In fact, there is a fire going in this room. You are, in the sense that you are all oxidizing. Whatever you ate for dinner, you're all oxidizing it right now, and that's keeping you alive. However, it is not producing the, it doesn't require the enormous amount of energy that is necessary, enormous by biochemical standards, in order to get the reaction going. If you had to literally light a fire inside yourself every time you digested your dinner, well, there is no way that a biochemical system could afford to throw away that kind of energy, the amount of energy that's necessary to get a fire going. And then after you have done it, the amount of energy that would come out of the reaction, even though it is greater than the amount that you put in, would in fact be so great that it would kill you. You know, if you had a fire going inside, you wouldn't live very long. But instead, you have catalysts. And the catalysts that are used in biochemical systems are called enzymes. And so if you didn't know before, you just finally found out what an enzyme is. It is not simply something found in detergents. An enzyme is a catalyst which is used in biochemical systems to allow reactions like that to go much more easily, so you don't need very much energy to get them started, and to allow the energy to come out at a controlled rate. And so your temperature, instead of being that of a fire, is 98.6 degrees, I hope so anyway, and you know, that's an example of what we're talking about. Well, there are plenty of non-biological chemical reactions, catalytic reactions, that happen in nature as well. Suppose that's what was going on in here instead. Okay, but you see, we've already narrowed down the possibilities. We've already eliminated whole fields of chemistry that you might imagine would have happened in here, but in fact haven't. So, you perform more observations. And you observe that very slowly, minute amounts of water vapor are appearing in the atmosphere. And then you would observe that very tiny amounts of methane and ammonia were appearing. Those are coming from the evaporation of your sweat. That's the scientific term for perspiration. And it would be very, very hard to explain that entire suite of reactions in terms of non-living chemistry. There are very few things which could be burning. In fact, I don't mean burning, I mean oxidizing by some catalyst-induced reaction, which would produce all of those effects simultaneously. And after a while, you begin to say to yourself, listen, we are getting so much complexity here that is so hard to explain in terms of any sort of equilibrium non-living chemistry, it really looks as though we discovered life. Okay, you see the procedure then? First, you find out what reactions occur, then you try to explain them in terms of life or in terms of non-living chemistry, then you try to make other observations or perform other experiments to differentiate between the two possibilities, and we are in some early stage of that process right now. It turns out there are all kinds of wild chemical reactions on Mars, weird things that we've never seen before, anywhere, in non-living chemistry or in living systems on Earth, acting together. And it's a very exciting discovery. whether it means that it is life or whether it means that the Martian soil has some sort of inorganic chemistry that is so bizarre by Earth standards that we literally had no idea it could exist. That we do not yet know. If there's life on Mars, it's pretty bizarre by Earth standards also. Very different from any kind of life that we know here. And so if it is life, right away we found out the answer to that question that I was asking about the range of variety that it's possible for life to have. Namely, that range is pretty big. For example, if there is life on Mars, it not only lives in the essentially complete absence of liquid water, which is the great universal solvent in which biochemical reactions happen on Earth. In addition, it seems, if there is life on Mars, and if we're interpreting things right, what we're getting from the Viking spacecraft, it looks as though when it dies, it doesn't leave any traces of itself behind that we can detect. And that is something that is really weird. It means the traces, by traces I mean organic chemicals, which would exist in any soil on the Earth in amounts that are detectable by the instrument that looks for them on the Viking landers, those organic chemicals are simply gobbled up by something, whether it's a living or whether it's more a non-living chemistry, so fast that it's just nothing like what you have on the Earth. So we've won already. We've discovered something of major importance, which is going to teach us something about the nature of life that we didn't know before. What it is, I repeat, I can't tell you at this early stage. Now, I want to tell you at this point, I want to begin moving towards telling you at this point, the findings from the three separate experiments that make up the Viking biology package, and to describe the three experiments to you in ways that I hope will make some sort of sense to you. I have to contrast the one from another, one with another, you know, so you understand why there are three of them. And the obvious variable in which to contrast them turns out to be the various assumptions that the three experiments each individually make. But I have found from experience that when you tell people about assumptions, right away they get very upset and they say, well, why don't you send up experiments that don't make any assumptions? The answer is because you can't. Any experiment, any scientific investigation necessarily makes assumptions about the thing that it's investigating. For example, suppose you were trying to study gorps and you've never seen a gorp before and you don't know very much about them. And you're going to be the world's first gorpologist. All right? The obvious thing to do, if you know anything about the phenomenon, is to get yourself together a big array of observational equipment and start seeing what it's like. If your observational equipment includes a camera, right away you have made an assumption. Gorps are not invisible. Lots of things are invisible. Gases, magnetic fields, thoughts. All right? So you're not studying anything which is in the nature of one of those. Gorps are not visible. If your experiment chamber is the size of a shoebox, you have made an assumption. Gorps are not microscopic, so it is reasonable to have a chamber that big. On the other hand, gorps are not the size of elephants. You expect to be able to fit them into that chamber. If it turns out the gorps are the size of elephants, well, you've lost your whole investigation just by making that one assumption. But you had to make some assumption about their size. There's no way you can avoid making an assumption about their size. If your chamber is open to the sky, you've made the assumption that gorps are not capable of flying away, of evaporating, of turning into energy and propagating out into space, etc., etc. You see what I'm getting at? There is no way you can avoid making assumptions. Of course, what you do when you know absolutely nothing about the phenomenon that you're studying ahead of time, not even whether it exists, as is the situation we have here with life on Mars, you try to make as few assumptions as possible, and the ones that you're forced to make, you try to make as general as possible, and the ones that you're really uncertain about, that you really feel it could go either way, you try to make those assumptions in two different experiments. And that's the reason that there are not one but three separate individual experiments in the Viking biology package. They all make different assumptions about this key question, how Earth life, as life elsewhere in the universe, specifically on Mars, got to be. One of them assumes quite Earth-like, one of them assumes not at all Earth-like, we're in Martian conditions, and the third just to hedge their bets as much as they can is sort of in between. And there are some other assumptions too, which I'll go through with the individual experiments. But first of all, I want to tell you about six assumptions which all three of the experiments hold in common. And most of them I think you will find pretty reasonable, but I want to identify them explicitly so that you will know about them, even the ones that sound pretty self-evident. I won't go through some of the really far out ones which are obvious we held in common. For example, that Martian life is made of matter, or that Martian life is not capable of walking through walls and getting out of the experiment chamber before you can study it, or that Martian life is not so clever that it knows how to fake the chemistry so as to make you think that it is not there, you know, or something like that. But aside from that level, let me go through the assumptions they all make. And I will deliberately start out with the one that is the most arguable, just to get it out of the way. This is the only one that I think really has a reasonable probability of not being a valid assumption. And that is that Martian life, like life on the Earth, is made of organic chemicals. Now, when I put it that way, it sounds self-evident. That's because most people don't know what the word organic chemicals means. There is, in fact, an entire industry of so-called organic food thriving on the fact that most people do not know what the word organic means. The word organic is one of those misnomers and crop up than carbon-based compounds. So if I had said the assumption that all three experiments have in common is that Martian life is based on carbon compounds, right away it would have sounded, you know, much less reasonable than if I say organic. Carbon is chemically a very interesting substance. It has the capability, and I'm not going to go into the atomic physics of why, although it's very interesting, but that would make the lecture even longer. It has the capability of combining with itself to form endless chains and rings and other large structures of atoms of carbon, to which other kinds of atoms, oxygen, nitrogen, all kinds of other things, are capable of combining themselves to form molecules of extreme complexity. And what life is all about is molecules of extreme complexity. If they're simple molecules, then you can't have the variety of phenomena which have to go on, and the amount of the subtlety, the variability that has to be able to go on in order to have what you call life, as opposed to the much simpler phenomena which you call non-living. So you've got to have very complex molecules, if you'll grant me the assumption that Martian life is made of matter. And on Earth, all life is based on the fact that only carbon has the capability of combining with itself to form these enormously complex molecules. It seems reasonable to assume that Martian life would be carbon-based for that same reason. Well, the word organic means nothing but carbon-based compounds, and the name is given not because organic chemicals are restricted to living things, as was in fact believed at one early stage in the history of chemistry. We've known better than that for more than a century. Really, the name organic simply means that those chemicals include the ones that living things are made of. And there are lots and lots of perfectly organic chemicals which have never seen a living thing, for example, DDT, which is totally artificial. It does not exist in nature. It is made in the laboratory, but it's an organic chemical. And so organic foods, considering what I've already told you about how, number one, we have to eat each other, and number two, we're made of organic chemicals, organic foods becomes, shall we say, a rather undefined term. Any food is organic. If you drank DDT, that too would be an organic food, by definition. And so you ought not to be very surprised when you have one of these studies about how somebody goes to an organic food store and finds that the pesticide residues are actually higher than in the A&P down the street. Why not? I mean, the pesticides themselves are organic, so the guy who's running the store is not committing fraud, but, you know, well, anyway, that's a separate topic. But the thing is, are there any other atoms which are capable of combining with themselves in the same way as carbon does, and therefore might form these backbones of the complex molecule, of molecules complex enough to be alive? The orthodox answer, which I'm sure most biochemists, in fact I know it, talking to them, most biochemists would give to that is absolutely not, it's ridiculous, don't waste my time with the idea. I'm not as convinced, because biochemistry, which means organic biochemistry, carbon-based biochemistry, is so complex and has so many weird things about it that nobody ever would have dreamed in a million years unless we had actually found them by having them presented to us in living things. You know, I can't imagine that anybody who had never seen a living thing on Earth but knew everything that there is to know about inorganic chemistry ever would have predicted the possibility. DNA, for example, and the whole genetic code set. And further work has been done on non carbon-based biochemistry for the actual reason we have none of it to study. So it wouldn't surprise me too terribly much if it turns out that even though the party line answer, which is the silicon, which is the only atom that is capable of combining with itself in anything like the same way the carbon can, you know the periodic table, silicon is right under carbon, the periodic table, so it has the same, it has very similar chemical characteristics. But as you go further down away from carbon, it gets worse and worse, it gets more and more different. Silicon is the only really good candidate for that. And in fact, the minerals which make up the solid body of our Earth are largely silicon compounds, and it is the fact that silicon is capable of combining with itself and also with oxygen to form endless chains that allows the enormous variety of minerals that exist on the Earth. But you know, there are only a few thousand minerals, whereas there are literally millions of organic chemicals. And so the party line answer has been, yes, silicon can do this, but not nearly the extent that carbon can, and there is no way to get the amount of variety out of silicon-based compounds necessary for a whole biochemistry. I'm not so sure. We've never seen one, and I really wonder if trying to work from first principles in our present ignorance of chemistry, which is really profound, I'm sure, would allow us to predict a silicon-based biochemistry if we had not had our noses roughed in one. However, in the case of Mars, I think that the assumption that the life is carbon-based is pretty good, because a silicon-based biochemistry at Earth temperatures, well, alone Mars temperatures, a silicon-based chemistry gives you minerals. You've got to have hotter temperatures for the molecules to be close enough to their melting or boiling point to be able to be fluid and flexible enough to support a biochemistry. And so most of what little speculation there has been about silicon-based biochemistry has been in terms of hotter planets than Earth. And Mars decidedly is not a hotter planet than Earth. The 2 days ago, the most recent Martian weather report that I've heard from Viking Lander 2, which is the northern one, and you know, it's just after the beginning of autumn now, the high temperature that day was 63 below zero Fahrenheit. I mean, even Michigan isn't quite that bad. So, although a friend of mine startled me by pointing out, actually when you count the wind chill index, our lows are just about equaling that Martian high. Now, it's not anything like the Martian lows, but still, that sort of shook me up a little, and that was such a neat idea that I pointed out to you and make you all shiver just a little more than you are doing. So, anyway, that's the one about carbon-based biochemistry, and it's probably a good one for Mars, even if, whether or not it's a good one elsewhere in the universe. All right, assumption number two. Living things must interact with their environment and thereby change the environment, and that, as I've already said, will allow you to detect the fact that they were there. All right, that sounds like a pretty reasonable assumption if you know life on Earth, because after all of these things have to get energy, and they get it from the outside. All living things do undergo chemical reactions, and those chemical reactions produce waste products, and they've got to get rid of them somehow. And so it seems like a very good assumption that living things must interact with their environment. And if you grant that assumption, then you can in fact detect them by detecting the interaction. However, if it is possible to have some sort of disembodied spirit being which coasts through the universe in blissful isolation from material reality, and that argument has been going on for thousands of years, and I'm not going to try to give you an answer to it. If they exist on Mars, then we're not going to detect them with the Viking biology instrument. And, Carl Sagan points out Venus is very close to the medieval description of hell. Well, maybe Mars is the medieval heaven, and if the angels are up there, we're not going to detect them with our crude material sensors that are this marvelous device called the Viking biology instrument. Number three sounds like an unreasonable assumption, but in fact it is almost inevitable if you'll grant the other two. In fact, if you'll grant just a second one, the one that I just said. And that is that Martian life, whether or not it's restricted to microbes, and that's a separate question, that is not an assumption that the instruments make, but whether or not Martian life is restricted to microbes, it's got to include microbes. Now, that one, unless you're a biologist, probably strikes you as an unreasonable assumption. I'm sure most people would have no trouble whatever imagining a world populated exclusively by things like trees and antelopes and tigers and nothing else. But in fact, that is a very reasonable assumption for this reason. If living things are made of complex chemicals, then when they die, those complex chemicals break down into simple chemicals. Simple chemicals, if they are carbon-based, are things like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, water. In other words, substances which are liquids and gases. and there's a general rule that all else being equal, a small molecule, which after all is lighter, may be a liquid or a gas, and you take these molecules and join them together to make bigger molecules, and you get solids. When you break down into small molecules, they tend to turn into liquids and gases. All right, what that means is that the substances that the organisms are made of are going to become dispersed widely through the environment after the organisms die, because the liquids and gases just don't stay in the same place. Now, if these organisms are made of a material substance which has to be, which is necessarily in finite supply on any given planet, you know, there's only a certain amount of carbon, for example, let alone the trace elements that are necessary for living things on Earth anyway. You know, very small amounts of arsenic are necessary for human life. Larger amounts will kill you, but you need a little bit of arsenic. And there just isn't very much arsenic on the Earth. And so you've got to endlessly recycle it. You've got to eat each other. And you've got to have an ecological balance among the living things on a planet. I've already said that before. Here I'm saying in a different context. For every organism, A, which excretes a waste product when it's alive, or which breaks down into a particular substance when it dies, there has got to be another organism, B, to which that substance is a nutrient. And that organism goes out and grabs the waste product from organism A and incorporates it into itself and thereby recycles it back into the biosphere, because you can bet your bottom dollar that somewhere along the line organism A is eating that organism or eating some organism that has eaten that organism and so on. And so carbon atoms, for example, are endlessly being recycled back and forth from one living thing to another and then into the non-living environment and then back into the biosphere and so on. And the same thing is true of all the others. If you are going to have recycling, you have got to have some mechanism for the recycling which is widely dispersed through the environment, just as the waste products are. And it seems very, and as a biological mechanism. And that's pretty much a definition of microbes, right? There is no way your antelopes and your tigers could go into all the nooks and crannies and ferret out all of the individual molecules of the substances which they needed and which had just been recycled out of the biosphere. And if you're not able to do that recycling with a very high degree of efficiency, well, you're simply not going to have a biosphere very long. So surely there must be microbes in the Martian ecology as scavengers, even if Martian life is not restricted to them in the way Earth life is not so restricted. The other assumptions are perhaps more reasonable or more obvious anyway, but I'll run through them quickly. Assumption number four is that Martian life is there at the landing sites where we landed at the time that we touched down. Now, that sounds like a pretty reasonable assumption on Earth. It may not be as reasonable on Mars. On Earth, there's at least microscopic life anywhere. Take any air sample, any soil sample, any sample of water from the Earth, and you will be able to culture microorganisms out of that sample. But the reason that life is ubiquitous, that means it's everywhere, on Earth, is that water is everywhere on Earth, at least in very small quantities. Even in the middle of the Antarctic winter, you can find small amounts of liquid water somewhere, and a drop of water is as good as an ocean if you're a bacterium. On Mars, there is not liquid water everywhere, and it is entirely possible that there is life only in certain special places on Mars. For example, places where there happens to be liquid water. Remember, there are some. Not in large amounts and only temporarily, but there are places where you can have an occasional drop of liquid water, as, for example, hoarfrost evaporates in the morning. Maybe Martian life is restricted to places where there's some other substance that we don't even know about, some necessary nutrient, which is available only at certain places on the planet. Or maybe Martian life is found only in places where it is protected from the ultraviolet radiation of the sun, which on Mars, unlike the Earth, gets all the way down to the surface because there is no ozone layer on Mars. Or dot, dot, dot. You see the idea. So it's not at all ridiculous to think that Martian life may not be ubiquitous, and in that case, we may very well have been unlucky in our choice of landing sites, and that's all there was to it. Particularly considering that the landing sites that were chosen for the Vikings were chosen with great care after thousands of man hours of work to be as atypical of Mars as possible, because we wanted to find sites as Earth-like as possible. Now, trying to find an Earth-like site on Mars is not going to bring you very far. There is no way you can get around the fact that even in the densest places, the atmosphere is 0.75% as dense as it is on the surface of the Earth, and it's made of totally different substances anyway. But at least we tried to find a place where it was reasonably warm, where there were, for Mars standards, abnormal amounts of water vapor in the atmosphere, and above that, where we could actually have liquid water on the ground, at least in small quantities for very short periods of time. Well, maybe we goofed, you know? We did that because there's only one kind of life that we know for sure to exist in the universe, and that's Earth-type life. And so we said to ourselves, all right, where would that be happiest if it was on Mars? And we tried to land there. But maybe we blew it on that assumption. Maybe Mars life is adapted for Martian conditions so well that Earth-like conditions are poisonous to it, just the way Martian conditions would be poisonous to most Earth-like. And maybe we have landed, after great care, in places which in Martian circles are shunned as being plague spots, as being centers of poison, areas to be avoided at all costs, the way we think of the crater of an active volcano, or Gary, Indiana, or something like that. And, you know, you have to make some assumptions, and the assumption that we made in our ignorance seemed like a pretty good one, trying to land in an Earth-like place, but maybe we will. You know, maybe if the Martians landed in Gary, Indiana, well, let's not dwell on that. Glad enough to land in an auto junkyard without landing in Gary, Indiana. Okay, and of course the assumption is made that Martian life can survive in our experiment chambers, and more than that, can reproduce to detectable quantities. And you can judge the value of that assumption for yourself as I describe in more detail how the experiments work. But let me point out that none of them, even the one that is most nearly Martian, pyrolytic release, none of them provides totally 100% Martian conditions. None of them gets anything as cold as it gets in normal conditions on Mars. They can't. You ruin them. You freeze them. And there's just no way around that. And besides, one necessary characteristic of a device which you are building to detect life on Mars is that you've got to be able to test the poor thing, and the only way you can test it is to see if it'll detect life on Earth. Well, you simply can't cool it to Martian temperatures and have it detect life on Earth, you know, because you kill the life on Earth. And so the temperatures are not Martian, and none of them provide a Martian day-night cycle. Now, that one is especially vicious, and here's the reason for it. Given the fact that all of them are too hot, it seemed more reasonable to have it too hot all the time and have the light on all the time or have darkness all the time than to present the organisms with the very un-Martian combination of the day-night cycle of light that they're used to on top of an unvarying temperature, you see? And maybe that's the wrong assumption too, but we had to guess somehow, and that's the way it was done. And finally, none of them provides that ultraviolet from the sun. Now, as I told you a while ago, ultraviolet does hit the surface on Mars, and that is usually considered as an argument against Martian life. And it's been pointed out that the amount of ultraviolet which hits the surface on Mars is greater than the amount that hits the typical surface in an operating room, which is being bathed by those germicidal ultraviolet lamps that they use to try to kill bacteria. However, let it be pointed out, there are bacteria which survive those lamps. The lamps are used because they're a cheap, easy, simple way to kill many bacteria, not because anybody claims they're 100% efficient. There's more to it than that. This is my own speculation. I haven't been able to find a biochemist who agrees with me, but I don't care because he doesn't know any more about Martian biochemistry than I do. So ignorance may help in this respect. But I can speak out of total ignorance here, and therefore with complete lack of prejudice. And I just wonder if there is life on Mars, if not only does it not mine the ultraviolet the way we usually picture that it does, and you have all these hypothetical Martian organisms that have thick shells around them to protect them from the deadly ultraviolet, so on. I just can't believe that nature wouldn't have dreamed of a way of using such a rich energy source as ultraviolet radiation, in the same way as on this planet, nature has dreamed of a way of using the powerful poison, oxygen, which was suddenly released into the atmosphere in large quantities about a billion years ago and very nearly wiped out life on Earth as a result. Greatest pollution event in the history of this planet. It dwarfs anything that man has ever done. All of a sudden, certain organisms, the first blue-green algae, developed the ability to get their own energy to keep themselves going much more efficiently than anybody had ever hit on before, namely photosynthesis, which is a much more efficient way of living than, for example, fermentation. And so, of course, as soon as this was developed, they exploded all over the planet. And
they started throwing away huge amounts of this seemingly toxic byproduct, oxygen, which is very, very energetic, one of the most reactive chemicals known, and for that reason, is so toxic. And as I say, it very nearly wiped out life on Earth. Fortunately, a few species, our ancestors, were able to adapt fast enough that they were able to survive, and furthermore, not only did they survive, but then they started using that even richer energy source, the oxygen, to develop their own energy, and it is only that that allows the development of intelligence on the Earth. Only oxidation is an efficient enough energy source to power the enormous variety and complexity and number of energy-draining reactions that are necessary for intelligent organisms to survive on this planet. In fact, for organisms of any complexity, you know, cockroaches, let alone human beings. Really, kind of an irony, but the only reason we're here is because of the greatest pollution event on the history of this planet. But the fact remains that it happened on this planet, and by the way, you may not be aware of the fact that oxygen remains a toxin, even to you. And even organisms that require, such as you and me, have had to develop elaborate defense mechanisms inside their cells to get rid of that oxygen, or at least to immobilize it chemically, before it can be around very long, and therefore do very much harm. And we did, our ancestors did develop such mechanisms, and they developed them fast enough to be able to survive in a rather rapidly changing environment when that oxygen was released. And that happened rather suddenly by geologic time standards. I just wonder if nature has been able to do the same thing with the ultraviolet on Mars. And I can picture colonies of colleges of Martian scientists, if there are any, which I very highly doubt, speculating on whether there could be life on Earth, and assuring themselves that it could not possibly exist because of the unfortunate presence on that planet of an ozone screen which shields out the life-giving ultraviolet from reaching the surface of the Earth. Just wait and see. If there's Martian life, I predict that it uses ultraviolet to hurry the Earth. All right, and finally, assumption number 6, that Martian life is killed by being exposed to a temperature of 320 degrees Fahrenheit for 5 hours. And the reason that we make that assumption is, suppose you detect what you think is, in fact, Martian life.
We got to prove it somehow.
And one obvious way of proving it is, you run an experiment, and you culture these little beasties, and they've given off whatever waste product you're detecting, and you're very happy, and you think that it's because they're alive. All right, take another sample of the very same soil, and the spacecraft is designed so that it keeps another sample of the soil ready in a topper for this very purpose. You dump it into the chamber, and you redo the experiment after you have heated that soil to a temperature which is hot enough to kill any living thing on Earth, 320 degrees. Note that our first response to the discovery of life on Mars is to kill it, to make sure it really was alive. It's a very important principle. Okay, suppose 320 degrees doesn't kill them. Maybe anything is tough enough that it can survive all that ultraviolet has developed some sort of shell. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it does require a shell. Or maybe the shell is just the equivalent of our defense mechanisms against oxygen, and so I'm right and they're right. In any case, suppose that shell just happens as an accidental byproduct to protect against high temperatures. That wouldn't be something that evolution would have selected for on Mars. You never get temperatures like that on Mars. But just suppose it so happened that it worked that way as an accidental byproduct. Then we'd be detecting life on Mars without even realizing it. And when I show you the experiment data, you can judge for yourself whether or not that might actually have happened. Because I'll show you some control runs that way. You call that a control run when you've done it on the heated soil. And I'll show you some which, well, they're kind of strange, I'll tell you. Okay, let me tell you now about the three individual experiments and their results. The Viking Lander biology package, as I think I've already mentioned in an earlier lecture, is only one of three instruments which study the Martian soil. The other two being the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, GCMS, which studies organic chemicals, if any, in the soil, and the X-ray fluorescence experiment, XRMP, which studies what the soil itself is made of. However, the biology package itself is subdivided into three separate experiments, like the Christian God, three in one. And the Father is gas exchange, the Son is labeled release, and the Holy Ghost is pyrolytic release. Okay? Three separate experiments that make up the biology package. Now, this unfortunate duplication of the number 3 has gotten at least 95% of the reporters who tried to report this thing hopelessly confused. I've seen any number of newspaper articles about how there are 3 biology experiments, one of which looks for organic chemicals in soil. I'm sorry, that's not the way it goes. The organic chemicals are the GCMS, which is separate from the biology package. So let's try to get those straight. And each of the experiments, as I said, make different assumptions about, number one, how Earth-like the conditions that are required for Martian organisms are, and number two, what specific reactions are the best to look for if you are trying to detect life on another planet. By the way, this whole thing about exposing to Earth-like conditions may seem kind of silly to you, considering that Mars is not very Earth-like, but remember, please, from the geological evidence that I've shown you, Mars has had more Earth-like conditions in the past. And it's entirely reasonable to imagine that if present-day Martian conditions are in fact too tough for life to exist there, maybe life was able to develop at some time in the past, and it's hanging on in the form of some sort of spores or other Martian equivalent underground, waiting for the next time when it's night, and you can wake them up by a sort of Prince Charming kit, which consists of supplying more Earth-like conditions. Or as Linda Sagan, Carl Sagan's wife, put it, the recipe for detecting life on Mars may simply be add water. Well, gas exchange, the most Earth-like of the three, is the one that has water. Let me tell you about gas exchange first, since it is the most Earth-like. It gives its soil sample lots of water, liquid water, which means that it's got to have a higher air pressure inside it than it exists in normal areas anywhere on Mars. It has not only lots of water, it has that water, dissolved in that water, lots of complex nutrients. The famous Viking chicken soup. Gas exchange is the chicken soup experiment. And it tastes rather like chicken soup, as a matter of fact, sort of warm and brothy-like. And the nutrients, these are substances which, by Earth standards, are nutrients. And they can keep even you alive for months. Eventually you die, but they could keep you alive for a long time, and they can keep many, many, many microorganisms on Earth alive indefinitely. Well, that's on Earth. Maybe on Mars some of the things are deadly poisons. Maybe only one of them is a deadly poison, which is all it would take. You've got to make some assumptions. If you don't like that assumption, well, there's another experiment that has no nutrients at all. It's a more Martian, a pyrolytic release. But this one gives us the Viking chicken soup, and it assumes that Martian organisms, if they don't prefer an Earth-like climate, can always live in it, right? Really, this is all the assumption that it makes, that it's going to be able to detect them. You know, maybe they're dying like flies, but a few of them manage bravely to survive and give an indication that they exist there. And they will come to life if you add water or nutrients. Maybe water is the limiter, maybe nutrients are the limiter, and so it's arranged so we can add them one and then the other. You could argue it either way. You could argue that, as I say, some of these things are poisonous and you ought to give it more Martian conditions. Well, there are many soils on the Earth which give absolutely no indication of life until you have added either water or nutrients, and then all of a sudden it turns out they were just lousy with microbes which were hibernating down there waiting for the good times to come back again. And there is no way to detect life in these Earth soils until you have added the water or the nutrients. Not even by running through the soil grains under a microscope. And we know what to look for in the case of Earth soils, and we can't find them. On the other hand, many Earth organisms from extreme environments not only do not appreciate what we think of as better conditions, they die when exposed to those better conditions. And there are some really extreme environments in which organisms can live, even here on the Earth. These are microorganisms, and this is the reason why we tend to think that if there is life on Mars, it is restricted to microorganisms. That's not a necessary assumption, but most people tend to think that way. Because the extreme environments on Earth, you couldn't live in, and they can. For example, there are bacteria which live, and algae as well, which live very happily in the boiling hot springs and geysers in Yellowstone National Park. Now, you couldn't live there, but they can. There are bacteria which can live in boiling sulfuric acid, but die if exposed to the oxygen in the air. And if there's been oxygen in the air for a billion years in this planet, they're still with us. There are bacteria which live in the almost boiling and highly radioactive water that is used to cool nuclear power plants. And not only live there, but I'm told they grow so profusely that they occasionally become a nuisance. They clog the plumbing and you've got to go in there and get rid of them somehow. And the most extreme example that I know of is the colony of bacteria, an earth bacterium, a common respiratory tract bacterium, Streptococcus mitis. It's harmless, although some of its relatives are not, and you've all got them in you right now, which was found in the television camera of Surveyor 3, which had been brought back by the astronauts of Apollo 12, and these things were still alive after 2.5 years on the moon. 30 months of no air, no heat, lots of heat, 220 degrees above zero in the daytime, 250 below at night. No food, no water, no protection from cosmic radiation. They were still alive. Now, obviously, higher forms of life, which being higher are more complex and therefore are more fragile, cannot put up with this sort of extreme environment the way microorganisms, which are simpler and therefore more adaptable, can. And what it comes down to is, of the kind of life that we know can exist, namely Earth life, microorganisms can survive, certain kinds of them, in Martian conditions in the laboratory if you add a little bit of water, and no higher form of life can. And so if you want to assume that there are macrobes on Mars, as Carl Sagan's term for anything is not a microbe, you've got to assume something else that we don't know, and that is that evolution could, starting out with simple organisms, which could survive on either Earth or Mars, create more complex, more fragile forms adapted to Martian conditions, which perhaps could exist on the Earth, but so what? That's not what they're trying to do. And that's something we just don't know about. Well, the thing is that when you take organisms that survive in these extreme conditions and put them into what you think of as a nice environment, they often don't appreciate it and express their disapproval by kicking off. For example, have you ever heard of halophilic bacteria and algae? These are organisms, halophilic means salt-loving, and that's putting it mildly. Some of them can live in 30% salt solutions. If you take those organisms and you put them in nice, clean, fresh running water, kind you like, they not only die, they explode. The entire cell blows apart, autolysis. And that's just one example. So you see, you could argue gas exchange either way. Some soils you can't detect at all until you put them in life at all, or even on Earth, until you put it in gas exchange. And others, you put it in gas exchange and it kills them. You've got to make some assumptions. Here are the results so far. The very, very first Viking biology result that was ever released came from gas exchange. Therefore, it was almost the only one that was ever covered by the news media. And as usual, they got it wrong. And so most of you have probably heard about it and are about to be shocked when I tell you what really happened. What happened was, as soon as the very first soil sample was put into gas exchange and the first water vapor was exposed to it, it was also exposed to higher heat, and there was this big argument about whether it was the heat or the water vapor, and a later run proved it was the water vapor that did it, so I'll just jump ahead and give you the answer. As soon as it was exposed to water vapor, surprising amounts, which means anything greater than zero since we were expecting none, of oxygen appeared in the atmosphere in the CO test chamber. In other words, there's something in the soil which gives off oxygen at the rate of about 1/1,000,000,000th of an ounce per thimbleful per cubic centimeter. So, you know, don't get too excited. It's not as though the air suddenly turned to half oxygen or something like that. But still, nobody was certainly expecting any oxygen to come off. And this was given off as soon as the soil was exposed to water vapor. Okay, this one I imagine many of you remember from last summer, right? All right. I wonder how many of you know that oxygen is not due to photosynthesis and was never thought by anybody to be possibly an indication of life, except by the reporters. Because it isn't photosynthesis, gas exchange happens to be run in total darkness. And it certainly is, it just doesn't behave the way life is supposed to behave. If you have living things which are giving off oxygen as a byproduct, as a waste, the way plants do, at least the way green plants do, well, what happens is they grow slowly, and as they grow and multiply, the amount of oxygen slowly reaches a peak, and then it slowly declines as they use up their nutrients in the test chamber, and then they get killed off. What happened here was, you add the water vapor, and wham, all the oxygen comes out in about a four-hour period, and then nothing further happened for weeks thereafter. And that is simply not the way life behaves. But what it did show is an extremely important discovery. Namely, that there is some non-living chemical in the Martian soil which is oxygen-rich and unstable. and will give off that oxygen that it contains at the slightest provocation, namely a little bit more water vapor than it gets in natural Martian conditions. In other words, right away, the very, very first finding from the Viking biology package was an accidental finding from an experiment that was designed to look for life on Mars of a major geochemical property of the Martian soil, and furthermore, this put us on our guard, there is weird chemistry going on Mars. There is nothing like that substance, whatever it is, we still don't know what it is. Whatever it is, there is nothing like it in Earth's soils for the excellent reason that there is so much water in any Earth soil, even the driest. There's at least water vapor there, and that would have decomposed it, and if the water vapor didn't, the microbes would have, and so the oxygen simply wouldn't be there. What is this substance? Well, there are a number of exotic classes of chemicals which are oxygen-rich and which will decompose when exposed to heat or water vapor or both. And examples, well, there are three classes. There are peroxides, superoxides, and ozonides, which are the most exotic of all, the compounds of ozone. Peroxides are the only one you're likely to have heard of if you're not a chemist. Hydrogen peroxide owes its bleaching action to the oxygen that it gives off when you add water to it. Okay? Superoxides are even more unstable, and they will decompose just when exposed to heat, let alone water vapor. And as a matter of fact, potassium superoxide is used by the Soviets as their standard oxygen source in their Soyuz manned spacecraft. They simply have some of it sitting around the corner of the cabin in a container, and it decomposes at a controlled rate in the temperature of the cabin and gives off a steady supply of fresh, breathable oxygen. Kind of neat, very simple solution. And ozonides are even weirder. So there is some sort of oxygen-rich chemical in the Martian soil, and that is a very important discovery, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with life, except that its presence is a little bit arguing against the existence of life on Mars. And it's really ironic, exactly the opposite of what all the reporters saw, because they think oxygen, that means life. But oxygen is toxic. Life on Earth was very nearly destroyed by all that oxygen, and now that it turns out that there is an oxygen source on Mars, which is likely to suddenly give off oxygen when some poor living thing, for example, disturbs it, well, that means that Mars life, too, would have had to evolve through the same crisis as Earth life did, the same oxygen crisis, and presumably it's a little bit harder for it to have done that, and therefore a little bit less likely to still exist than if it hadn't had to put up with that. So ironically, that oxygen was not in a strong way, but just a little count against life on Mars. The other findings have been very unexciting, and there is no way that anybody would claim that any of them are alive. What happened is that when they finally, nothing more happened when it was in the human mode, they were just exposed to water vapor. And then when they finally put it in the Viking chicken soup, what happened was the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere went down somewhat. And it went down at a steady rate, which is characteristic of non-living chemical reactions, not the sort of exponential growth and decay curve, which is what you're used to in living organisms. And all that proves is the soil is alkaline, and when you wet it, it eats carbon dioxide. Okay, an interesting geochemical finding again, but nothing having to do with rock. And it's not very alkaline, nothing would kill anything alive, but, you know, in lots and lots of Earth soils. So what they did after nothing more happened, for quite a long while after that, was they flushed out the atmosphere, including all that oxygen, which by now had long since stopped being given off, on the theory that maybe the oxygen was in fact holding back living things, and maybe if we got rid of it, we'd be able to see something after all. And so they put in a fresh supply of nutrients and a fresh supply of Martian gas exchange kind of air. And what happened was carbon dioxide started to be slowly given off by the soil. Okay? First of all, we were eating it up. Now we're slowly giving it off. So, again, it was at a very slow rate. It did not look as though it was alive. And that experiment, they started on the 8th Martian day that Viking Lander 1 was on the surface, and they are still running it. Same soil sample. And it is still slowly giving off carbon dioxide and doing absolutely nothing else. And they keep flushing out the air, putting in new air, putting in new nutrients, and every time they give it a fresh charge, it gives up a little bit more carbon dioxide, but no indication whatsoever that it's anything but non-living chemistry. Well, on Lander 2, this was a site where there was more water vapor. And I told you about that, and told you about the reasons for it in the earlier lectures. They went to that site for just that reason. It was an even wetter site, or let's say a more humid site, than the Viking Lander 1 site was. In other words, there was even more reflux.
Well, what would you expect, given what I told you about this mysterious oxygen-rich chemical in the soil, what would you expect to find if you went to a place where there was more natural humidity, given the fact that the stuff is decomposed by the presence of water vapor? What do you think? I've been doing all the talking. You tell me. Expect less oxygen to be given off, right? That's exactly what happened. All right, great. Confirmation of our hypothesis. Unexciting other than that, certainly not life. And the other things, the carbon dioxide bits, were exactly the same. And I have just summarized hundreds of days worth of experimental data. Gas exchange so far has been very unexciting, except for that one big discovery that there's weird geochemistry going on in the Martian soil. And right away, that put us on our guard. If you get unusual results or interesting results from the other experiments, that too might be just weird geochemistry instead of plus. And so gas exchange has done us a very valuable service for that. Well, one more thing, and that is that at Viking Lander 2, they finally got rid of their first sample since it was doing just the same thing as the one that Lander 1 did, and they put in a sample which had been collected from under a rock on the theory that the rock would protect the soil from ultraviolet, and maybe ultraviolet was killing the poor beasties, and so maybe where they live is under rocks on Mars. And that's reasonable, you know, you want to find life on the Earth, you turn over a rock and there are these things wiggling around, you know, why not Mars too? And so I showed you the fun that they had in finally turning over a rock on Mars, which is not an easy thing to do by remote control from 230 million miles away, but they've now done it several times, in fact, and gotten samples from under a number of rocks, and it looks as though they're leaving no stone unturned up there. Rocking around their way on. In any case, what happened was the exact same result, except there was even less oxygen. In fact, there was less oxygen at the Lander 2 site in the first sample, which was from the surface, than there was at the Lander 1 site. Well, in the under rocks sample, there was half as much oxygen as there was from the surface sample. And what that proves is that the rock acts as a trap for water vapor, and so it's even more humid under a rock than it is exposed to the surface, which after all means that you're being dried and so forth and so on. Again, the sort of thing you would expect. Again, interesting geochemistry, and again, nothing having to do with life. And that's it for gas exchange, folks. But there's one more thing that I'd like to point out along the general philosophy of negative results are important too, and that is, if there are any lingering doubts in your mind about whether the sterilization of those landers worked, the negative results from gas exchange prove that the sterilization worked. If the Viking landers had carried Earth bacteria to Mars and thereby contaminated with Earth life, gas exchange would have detected them by this time. So at least that's one worry off our minds. And furthermore, you don't have to worry about the Russian landers having carried bacteria to Mars. Either they did not, either they were sterilized the way the Russians say they were, or if they did, at least the bacteria haven't made it up from the southern hemisphere where they crashed to the northern hemisphere where the two Viking landers are. Laser release, that's the one in the middle, that's the one that is neither really Earth-like or really Martian, is the second most Earth-like. It uses a nutrient also, but it's a much simpler nutrient. It isn't this complex mixture of amino acids and vitamins and 19 different minerals and all kinds of good stuff that you have in the Viking chicken soup. And what that means is that if the Viking chicken soup is indeed poisonous to Martian life, and yet you've got to give the nutrients before they come into observability, maybe this is a reasonable compromise. There are only 7 nutrients on label release, and they're all single organic chemicals of a class called carboxylic acids. And all that you have to know about carboxylic acids is that it is very easy to oxidize carboxylic acids. That is to say, to break them down and get energy from doing so, which is why they are nutrients for living things on Earth. Formic acid, which in fact is in there in the form of a sodium salt, because the formic acid itself won't survive the sterilization heat, formic acid is the simplest carboxylic acid. Now, I'm sure you don't think of formic acid as a nutrient, but lots of bacteria, I guarantee, do. And formic acid is, if you're not familiar with it, is the stuff that an ant or a bee, which stings you, injects. And the reason that it hurts, because it is so highly acid, and the reason it's so highly acid is that it's so easily oxidized. Well, label release, in fact, looks for oxidation and only oxidation. What gas exchange is doing, I'm sorry, I forgot, I told you everything about gas exchange, what it does. What gas exchange does is exactly the thing that our imaginary extraterrestrial observers did in the air in this room. That is, it looks for any changes in any gases in the air above its soil sample. And since it is looking for anything at all, and constantly monitoring a whole bunch of different gas abundances, oxygen and carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide, if there were any, which there hasn't been on Mars so far, and a whole bunch of others, it can't be terribly sensitive. Label release looks for only one specific kind of reaction, namely oxidation. However, since it is more specific in that respect, it is capable of being much, much more sensitive. And label release could detect a reaction which was going on at a rate way below anything gas exchange would be able to pick up. On the other hand, it buys this sensitivity at the price of generality. So, again, it seems reasonable to have them both. Well, oxidation does not necessarily mean combination of oxygen, as a matter of fact. It's another of those unfortunate chemical terms that because you get energy out by taking complex organic substances and breaking them down into simple things like carbon dioxide, water vapor, and so on. There's energy stored in them in that sense. And so that's what you're doing when you digest your food. You are oxidizing it, basically, and getting energy in order to live on by that oxidation process. What are the organic chemicals that you are breaking down? Where did they come from in the first place? Why they were built up by the other side of the ecological cycle, namely plants. And so you see how it works. The plants build them up, and that's a process that requires putting energy in, right? If you get energy out by taking complex molecules, break them down into simple, well, to do it the other way and take simple ones and build them up into complex ones, then you've got to put energy in, and where the plants get that energy from is actually a bunch of sources, but the most famous one and the most important in Earth biochemistry is, of course, sunlight. They do this in photosynthesis. The opposite to oxidation, the process of taking complex substances building up complex substances out of simple ones is called by a very confusing name. It is, which sounds as though it's exactly the opposite of what I just described. It's called reduction. I'm sorry, you're just going to have to live with that. Reduction is what plants do, oxidation is what animals do, and so what happens is the carbon is constantly cycled. The plants build it up into complex things, the animals break it down into simple things, the animals then excrete it, and the plants take it back in and build it up into complex things again, and the energy that makes the whole cycle go is injected at this place where the plants are doing it, and it is coming from sunlight. And that's what makes life go on the earth. If I have gotten you interested in the whole question of biochemistry and how living things operate, and particularly how they get the energy to make them go, which is really what one of the big themes in biochemistry, I can only hint at it here. For one thing, I'm not an expert.